It's your time to Ed Up with America's leading higher education podcast network, the Ed Up Experience, where we make education your business. This is Ed Up Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. She's Dean at St. Mary's School of Law, and she's going to be leading conversations about legal education in today's world. Now let's hear from your host, Patty Roberts.
Welcome to Ed Up Legal. This is Patty Roberts from St. Mary's University School of Law. And today's guest is Ashley Kranelka Chase. She is an assistant professor of law at Stetson University School of Law. And welcome, Professor Chase.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. This is a very surreal moment. Anybody would want to interview me for anything. So,
well, once our guests hear the cool things that you're doing, they'll understand why we would want to interview you. But thank you for agreeing to be on the podcast. And I know that you at Stetson have taught legal research and writing and advanced research and technology courses. You were the associate director of the law library and coordinator of legal practice technology. And your research focuses on your scholarly agenda, focuses on the intersection of research, technology, and access to justice for incarcerated litigants. So I think I'd like to start with your transition from the library to the tenure track. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting time to transition. I think that we went home for COVID in March of 2020, as all of us did, and I was working from my closet in my master bedroom, and my husband was working across the room and seemed, you know, very into what he was doing and able to work and able to function. And I was sitting in my closet, staring at my spreadsheets and trying to teach a class from my closet and just sitting there thinking, what am I doing, right? The things that bring me joy are not the things that I can do from my closet. And I could do most of my administrative tasks from the closet because it was a lot of spreadsheets and meetings and things like that that I could do there. But I really started to miss the human interaction that I had with the students and the face-to-face contact and sort of the mentoring that happened with my students that I had as an adjunct. And I just became increasingly unhappy. I was getting really bad headaches and, you know, was very uncomfortable. And to top it off, I had three small kids downstairs. And it, you know, occurred to me that if I stayed on this track of staying in the library in this admin position, that I was going to be working long days and lacking some flexibility and seeing my daughters grow up. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. We came back to work. Libraries changed drastically during COVID. The resources we were able to provide for students changed drastically. Their use of the space changed drastically. And I didn't like it anymore. What used to be a passion, I didn't like anymore. And when this position for a tenure track R&W professor opened up at Stetson, I thought, well, I've taught research and writing to paralegals for a couple of years, and I've taught here at Stetson for almost 10 years. I'll throw my name in the hat and see what happens. And thankfully, they liked me. They continued to like me and wanted me to transition into this new role. And so over the course of this last summer, I moved from the library into a tenure track faculty position, which so far has been amazing.
That's awesome.
I pinch myself every day. I'm like, I don't know how I got so lucky. I have the best students. Everybody here has been so great about, you know, sort of helping me through this process. I got to write this summer without also having to do administrative work. And it was very strange because I love the writing. And so I was able to actually focus on writing an article and have that be something that is part of my job. I mean, like I said, it just feels very surreal. And I'm very grateful to be part of this community that I never in a million years would have thought that I would join.
Well, congratulations. And as you know, we talked about before we started, I had a circuitous route to faculty and came from clinician ranks to be dean. But I think increasingly, as we see with the numbers of applicants in the FAR, the Academy is going to have to look to less traditional candidates who perhaps have the right skill set that has been overlooked for too long. So I'm very delighted for you on your tenure track position. Congratulations. And it must be really cool in the summer to focus on what interests you from a research perspective and do some of that writing. I know you have articles that focus on prisoners and their access to justice through the research and technology that they have available to them. Tell us a little bit about that topic, what excites you about it, what troubles you about our current situation, and any suggestions you have for aiding this population.
Yeah, so I think that when we think about prisoners' rights, we are all very wrapped up in access to healthcare, access to food, access to air conditioning here in Florida. And I think Texas is similar, that a lot of our prisons don't have air conditioning. And
I just learned that. Yes, it's really troubling because it's hard with air conditioning.
Exactly. And those are very real concerns. And I don't want to minimize those concerns whatsoever. But, you know, our incarcerated litigants have rights to an appeal. In most instances, they have a procedure that they can go through at the very least to try and get, you know, post-conviction motions or appeals heard in the appellate courts of their states or the federal appellate courts. And a lot of them can't afford attorneys. We know that, right? That's a lot of times how they end up in prison in the first place. And I started doing a little bit of research into how this population of incarcerated people uses legal research tools. And they are, when they're researching in print, tearing pages out of books. Books are being stolen from the library. In my time with AALL, which is the American Association of Law Libraries, I learned that these library budgets are being cut pretty significantly. In Florida, the Department of Corrections budget doesn't exist for libraries anymore. They rolled it into educational resources, so you can't even see how much money they're putting towards materials for inmates. And it just startled me that they may not have access to the things that they need to pursue their appeals. And then I started reading more about the legal research algorithms that are part of Lexis and Westlaw and how deeply potentially unfair and biased those algorithms are. You know, they seem to, we don't know for sure because Lexis and Westlaw won't talk to us about it, but they know if you're a student or a faculty member, they know where you go to school. They know if you're in a big firm and a small firm, and you get different results based on a lot of those factors that not everybody pays that close of attention to. And so I thought to myself, well, if we're having this problem in law schools where students are getting uneven results by running the same searches, these poor incarcerated people are surely not able to get the results that they need if they can even get Lexis or Westlaw at all. Fast forward, you know, to more recent events, and Sarah Lambden, who's a professor at CUNY, wrote a book about how Lexis and Westlaw are selling all of our personal data to the government, and that includes incarcerated litigants, right, whose information may be wrapped up in the system. It's all being packaged and sold to ICE, Customs and Border.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, she wrote a whole book on it called Data Cartels. This isn't her interview. She's great. She's very interesting. But it's really sort of striking to see Lexis and Westlaw start to push products where you could accidentally leave a client name in a brief, and they want to tell you how to research for that particular document, and then they're selling that information to the government. And so simultaneously, prisons are starting to provide access to Lexis and Westlaw for inmates. And I just think to myself, well, that's wrong, right? Because if we're tracking people through use of Lexis and Westlaw and the information that they contain, then these poor people whose rights are already not as broad as the rest of us because they're in prison, right? How is that impacting them? And they probably don't understand what exactly is happening. And it's costing them a lot of money to access these resources. So some of them
Let me just ask, when you say it's costing them, it's costing the Bureau of Prisons or it's costing the prisoners themselves?
It depends on the jurisdiction. So a lot of the jurisdictions are contracting with private companies to provide tablets to the inmates. And the tablets are the only ways that the inmates can get on Lexis or Westlaw, or they'll have kiosks in the corner. And the inmates have to pay a fee to set up their accounts. They have to fund their accounts. They have to pay for the tablets themselves. They have to keep those accounts funded for administrative fees. And so it's sort of like a commissary fund where they're just constantly trying to get ahead of having the resources available to do the work that they need to do. but they're being taken advantage of. You know, the FCC curtailed high telephone rates for inmates. I think pretty soon we're going to have to see something happen with internet access fees, legal research fees for inmates. I don't know what that looks like. Or in my most recent article, I talk about the fact that perhaps our state governments should expand what fall under edicts of government for government published information, like statutes, like annotations, so that inmates can have more access to government information that's not subject to copyright, so it can't be controlled by Lexis and Westlaw. So this is all a very winding way to say, right, we have a pretty significant problem with access to information, which is a constitutional right for our incarcerated people. And I think that nobody has taken account of the fact that the tech has changed the way that constitutional right operates for these people, and something's got to give, or they essentially aren't going to have a right to appeal anymore.
Well, that is so much to unpack. We have a short period, but I will just say you have taught me some things that that are astonishing. Not the least of which is that when we charge for these kinds of services that are, pretty essential to an access to justice for incarcerated individuals, we are again giving to the haves and not the have-nots, right? So it's still breaking down on socioeconomic lines, even though we're talking about individuals who are all incarcerated.
Right. Yeah, it's a significant issue. I mean, even if you look at if these folks can afford private attorneys versus public defenders, right, the private attorneys are going to be paying for a much more robust legal research system than the public defender's office is able to have access to. And so even if you can get representation, your legal research representation is not going to be equal unless we do something to stop these predatory publishers from controlling what should be edicts of government, things that should be in the public domain that anybody can use so that they can navigate their way through the system, whether it's criminal or civil.
My goodness. Okay. Well, that's a troubling topic for another day that we'll expand on, but I'm glad that you're research is exposing some of these troubling facts about their access, and then also just the disparities in that access. I want to focus on something else that you have been involved in publishing, not just your articles, but you had a new book come out in February 2021. And that's what originally caught my eye and made me reach out to you and say, I want you to be on the podcast, because you have a book called Millennial Leadership in Law Schools, Essays on Disruption, Innovation, and the Future. And there are a variety of authors and essays, and it talks about the role millennials will play, not just as students, which is what I originally thought when I read the title, but on millennials as faculty, administrators, and staff members, and what role they'll play in shaping the future of legal education. So tell us more about the book.
So I wrote back in 2016, edited a book about millennial leadership in libraries, and had librarians from all over the country and different kinds of libraries write chapters for that book on how libraries are going to change under the leadership of millennials. And that book was pretty well received and pretty popular and sparked some really interesting conversations. And so I went back to my editor at Hine and said, I think I'd like to do something similar for law schools. And there was a little bit of pushback, not from her, but when I started talking to people about, you know, I think this is a good idea. There are more of us, who are joining the ranks of law school staff, law school faculty. There was a little bit of like, really, millennials? For whatever reason, millennial is like the most negative connotation, or has like the most negative connotation of any generational marker, it seems, half of the time. Like,
was it from us boomers?
I don't think so. If anybody dislikes us the most, I think it might be Gen X, but we won't go into all of that right now. But there was just a little bit of like, really, millennials are working in law schools? Aren't you all still students? There's this misperception that, you know, millennials are still our students. Well, I am almost 40, very much millennial, right? And our students now are Gen Z. So we're in the middle ground, right? Where
So you're graduates.
We're graduates.
And you're entering the academy as employees.
Right. We're out there trying to like join the ranks and like do cool things and bring our brand of expertise to the forefront. And so, but a lot of us, I think, didn't realize that in order to go work at a law school, we would have to have a PhD or a fellowship, things that you and I talked about this a little bit earlier, that I would have seen as a barrier to entering the academy had I thought about joining a law school faculty when I was in law school, because I wouldn't have had the money to do a PhD. I really wanted to go out and work in the legal field and see what I liked and what I didn't like. And I liked the work that I had done as a student. I worked in-house for an engineering company and I found that very rewarding. And I really liked that. And I didn't want to see that as a barrier to potentially doing what I'm doing now. And I think a lot of people now look at who's applying for these jobs and they would see that practical experience as a barrier to entry, certainly to enter the faculty side of it, maybe not the staff side of it. Mm-hmm. And so I put out this call for proposals to put together chapters for the book and had an overwhelming response from particularly law professors, but also from administrators in career development offices, in academic support offices, in student services, who said, you know, we are all millennials and we want to, or we're working very closely with millennials and we see the significant changes that they're trying to make despite a lot of pushback. And so the book was born from that. And it covers five different areas that I think are important to the future of legal education, particularly with millennials at the helm, which we're not, right? But we're trying. Talks a lot about relationships and the classroom, right? What millennials look like in the classroom, how we interact with each other and how we mentor with each other. And it brought together a lot of things that I think folks who think millennials are just narcissistic pains in the butt that they don't want to work with. I think that it brought to the forefront, right, that we do have these good ideas that are maybe a little bit different and maybe they're a little bit more geared towards practice as opposed to more traditional doctrinal classroom style thinking, but that this is the way legal education is going, right? And this is the, you know, the changes that we're seeing from the ABA about experiential education and needing faculty to actually teach our students how to practice law. I think that millennials have a lot of good ideas about how to do that stuff. And we're the ones out there trying to make it happen, despite sometimes pushback from our colleagues who may be a little older. I hate to say that, but it's true.
So in addition to increasing practice opportunities and maybe practice experience among the academy's faculty members, what other themes came out from the essays in your book?
There's a lot about technology, which I think is sort of inherent anytime you talk about a younger generation coming up. One distinction that's sort of drawn in the book is between those of us who I would call elder millennials. That's a term that I stole from the comedian Eliza Schlesinger, right? Those of us who are Oregon Trail generation, on the cusp between Gen X and millennial, where we didn't necessarily grow up with computers or the internet. We remember that shift to when all of those things entered our homes and how we had to figure out the tech for ourselves and for our parents and for our younger siblings. Having taught tech classes here at Stetson for so many years, I had students come into my class who have never evaluated a piece of technology before. They would open an app. If it didn't work, they would close it again and find something else. And I think that there's this misconception that our younger students, these digital natives, understand technology, but they don't. The tech is an extension of them. And if it doesn't function, they move on to the next thing. And they don't try and make it work for them in the way that those of us who used WordPerfect and used to go in and change the tags of WordPerfect knew how to make the tech work for us. And so I think that the tech skills that a lot of us are bringing to the classroom, one, more closely mimic what the students may see in practice, but two, increase that connection with our students and meet them where they are in a way that maybe we haven't in the past. There's also a couple of really important chapters on diversity that were written by Gaga Gondwe, who's at the University of Wisconsin right now, and Haley Moss. Haley Moss writes about, she's an outspoken autistic attorney, and she writes a lot about how we can increase accessibility in our classrooms, how millennials are more well poised to do that because we are actually willing to talk about those things with one another and with younger folks in a way that makes it seem less like a barrier and more like an opportunity for changing law schools. And then Gaga's article, she wrote specifically about some of the diversity studies that were done at Yale when she was a student there and the burden that the schools put on their students of color to fix diversity issues within the academy and how millennials, because we're more aware of these issues overall, because we have seen how some of these things have played out, that we are better poised to take on diversity as an institution and make it everybody's problem instead of heaping more work, more trauma, more effort onto our colleagues of color. Her article, I think, is essential reading. And if I could like slap it on the screen right now and ask podcast listeners to read her article, I mean, it's really, it was really profound and is honestly the best chapter in the book. But I think it really highlights some of the things that millennials bring to the table that our other colleagues may have sort of shied away from dealing with in legal education.
Do you think or do you see that Gen Z is considering the kinds of things that you're describing, the increased technology, the increased diversity? Are these things that Gen Z future students are looking for in law schools? Are they aware of these differences between law schools?
No, the answer to that yet. You know, this is my first year teaching first year students. And so some of what I'm seeing or hearing from them is that they're hearing that my class is a little different from other classes because of the amount of practice ready things I'm doing in class. My 1Ls are writing client letters, and that's sort of different than I think has been done before. We're really trying to focus on client interviewing skills in class so that they have to get a very loose fact pattern and then actually ask me the client questions to get the information they need to do the work for the class. I think that that's sort of unusual. I think they're used to being asked questions in the Socratic method style. I don't think they're used to asking the questions necessarily. So I think that they're starting to talk about the differences maybe between a class like mine and some other classes, which I think is good that that's teasing it out. They have also made comments to me about how much more tech heavy my class is than some of their other classes. And so they're aware of that. They're also struggling with the technology. They're struggling with being asked to incorporate tech in a way that mimics practice a little bit more closely. And so I do think that if they aren't aware yet of how important those things are going to be in practice when they get out, they will become more aware as they get more in touch with faculty who are focused on experiential ed and mimicking practical situations in the classroom. And I think that that needs to start in the first year.
Absolutely. But, you know, for those of us who hear you saying, you know, I have an increased amount of technology in my course and they're not used to that. What does that look like? Clearly, it's more than PowerPoint slides.
Yes. Very few PowerPoint slides, as a matter of fact. We do a lot of collaborative documents in my class. So they are given a collaborative note-taking document at the beginning of every week where I encourage them to take notes together as a class on a shared document and ask each other questions in the document and answer each other's questions because studies have shown that you learn better when you're teaching. And so if they can answer each other's questions, that works a little bit better. I have a Microsoft form that I use for feedback. So if they have questions that they don't want to ask in class or they're not comfortable, they can provide me feedback that way. They are using styles in Microsoft Word to figure out how to write client letters, things that they will be asked to hit the ground running and do when they're out. And then I'm also making them think, of course, about these legal research problems that perhaps other folks are not quite ready to talk about. And I told them, I was like, you have the disadvantage of having a former librarian as your research and writing professor. So we're going to talk a lot about the issues with legal research. And so I'm making them focus on free and low cost ways to perform legal research so that they don't get completely in bed with Lexis and Westlaw to the point where they're just clicking on everything and they're not paying attention to how they're utilizing those databases. And I do think that that's a pretty stark difference between the way a lot of people approach, you know, classes, which is Lexis and Westlaw. The reps are willing to come into the class and that's easy. And it takes the burden off of me. And it would be a lot easier if I asked a rep to come into my class and teach research, but that is never going to happen.
And if you're focusing on those low cost or free resources, do you find that the students can get the job done just as well or almost as well as with the paid resources?
Yeah. So in Florida, we're lucky that our free website for statutes anyway is excellent. So the Florida legislature actually does a really good job of putting the statutes online for free. I encourage my students to use FastCase, which is provided to them through the Florida Bar after they graduate. So if they become members of the Florida Bar, they will have FastCase for free. FastCase certainly gets the job done. And then I talk to them about the importance of using paid databases for citators, because so far there is not another equivalent, a free or low cost equivalent to Shepherds or Key Citing. And I'm aware of that, right? And that's money well spent, because you don't want to make a fool of yourself when you are out in practice. You want to make sure that your research is current and hasn't been overruled and things like that. And so I think just getting them to understand that there are options out there that don't involve paying a ton of money to Lexis and Westlaw. If I can get that point across, I feel like I've done my job, even if they do end up in the arms of the paid databases and loving them later on.
Well, that's good to hear. And then since this is your first year doing this on the tenure track, if you project forward to what technologies you might want to incorporate that you're not doing this first time out, what other sorts of things are you thinking that students should be aware of in law school because they will be needing it in practice?
So I have the opportunity to talk to our 1Ls at orientation about tech things as well. And we talk about timekeeping and how keeping track of your time when you're in law school can actually help. That way, if you're struggling when you're studying, you have a record of how you spent your time that you could take to a faculty member and say, you know, I read this case 8 different times and I don't understand it. Can you please help me? Why don't I understand it with the reading? So I would like to, in the future, incorporate more timekeeping type skills into my classes. And I think that are here, research and writing too, which is your advocacy writing for the courts, that lends itself pretty well to timekeeping. So that may be something that I try and fold into that class. I'm really big on teaching my students email etiquette and making sure that they know how to schedule meetings with me. I tell them, I don't want to go back and forth with you about when is a good time for a meeting. You can busy search my calendar. You can put a meeting on my calendar. And as long as the email that goes with it is appropriate, I will accept your meeting and we will have it, you know, when you put it on my calendar. Because a partner in a firm isn't going to go back and forth with them 17 times about when is a mutually agreeable time for a 5-minute meeting.
That's for sure.
Show up on their calendar. Yeah. So those are the big ones. And like I said, I am lucky that I get to talk to them about that at orientation. And I have seen a significant change in the professionalism and the tone of our students' emails since we started doing this at orientation. Because there were years there where I was getting some very casual emails from students that were painfully inappropriate. And we seem to have course corrected that, which is good. So if I've done nothing else, I've done that.
Well, that's huge. How much time do you spend talking to students about that in orientation?
I get 30 minutes and we
come. Oh my gosh, and it made that much of a difference.
It really did. And you know, the thing that I drill into them at orientation is that nobody will be offended if you call them professor. And I say it over and over again. Everybody on this campus, you should call professor until they tell you otherwise. And that alone has made a big difference, because especially as female members of the faculty, and I know that our colleagues of color experience similar issues where the students think, for whatever reason, that we can be called by our first name.
Right.
And just saying that, right, I don't care if you're emailing a member of the dining staff, call them professor. Nobody's going to get mad. And then they can correct.
Well, I'm glad you've had success with that. I know there is a casual approach, almost like they're transferring their texting skills to emails. And now that emails are replacing snail mail, you have got to make it proofread. It's got to be respectful. It's got to be, you know, it's got to make sense in a way that our casual conversation or texting would not.
Right, right. Exactly. And so far, so good. So
good. Well, good for you. So before we conclude, I'm going to ask the question that I ask of all my guests, and that is, how do you see legal education evolving in the coming decade?
So this is one where I worry about saying something that's going to make somebody angry. because I really do think that in order for legal education to evolve in a way that best serves our communities and that best meets the significant justice gap that we have in this country with the people who are not reaching out and getting attorneys, I think we've got to get over ourselves a little bit and stop minimizing people to rankings or reducing people to their rankings. I think that that has a trickle-down effect for clients. And what I mean by that is, you know, before we get to law school, we take the LSAT, we have our GPA, and we are ranked, right? You're worthy of a scholarship. You're not worthy of a scholarship. You can get into a T14 school. You can't get into a T14 school, right? So we're ranked before we even get to law school.
Right.
And then you start law school and then they start ranking you again, right? Your class rank is whatever it is. Your GPA is whatever it is, but that class rank, I can remember filling out on-campus interview forms and them saying, what's your class rank? And I was like, well, it's not good. After my first year and thinking, well, I was inherently less than, right? Because my class rank was not that good. And then when we look at who wants to join the academy, who wants to be faculty members, right? We rank those people. They're ranked based on, have you had a fellowship? Do you have a PhD? Where did you go to law school? And if you look at the numbers on the Law Profs blog website, right? It's a lot of people from top 14 schools are the ones who are worthy of joining law faculties. And I think that that trickles down. I think that students see that certain faculty are deemed worthier than others and therefore more capable of teaching, more capable of teaching them what they need to practice. And then I think that some of that trickles down to how we treat clients. And that we sort of inherently, because now we have lived with rankings for 3 or 4 years, now all of a sudden we're looking at clients and maybe we're ranking them subconsciously and saying, well, this client has a little bit more money, so I will spend more time, right, on this particular case, as opposed to spending time with this other client whose case may be stronger, but doesn't have the money to pay me in a way that I deserve to be paid for the work I'm being done. And I think that that exacerbates the justice gap. You know, we have seen an increase in lawyers and a decrease in people seeking legal services over the last, I think it's 10 years, and I have actual data on that. I'm not just pulling that number out of nowhere. But I think the reason for that is lawyers are seen as inaccessible. And part of the reason that lawyers are seen as inaccessible is because we rank each other and we talk about how fancy we are all the time. And that doesn't do anybody any good to sit and listen to lawyers, you know, quibble about where they went to law school or whether or not their law degree is as good as somebody else's. And therefore that makes them worthy of teaching the next generation of lawyers. What our students need are people who care about the law, who understand the law, and who can talk about the law in a way that the students also understand it. It doesn't have to be this pedestal thing where you're constantly talking to people about the legal field as if what we are doing is some sort of like sacrosanct, like, I just think that that really puts a sour taste in people's mouth. And it's why there's lawyer jokes and it's why people don't want to hire lawyers. And so I would like to see us get away from that, to hire more people from practice to come and teach our students and just to change the way we think about ranking everything.
All right. Well, I appreciate your suggestion, and it'll be interesting to see. Certainly there are less people applying for legal education jobs or law professor positions this year than I think they have seen historically in the faculty register. And so it will be interesting to see, what do we do as schools? Because we all need more faculty than it seems we've needed before. And where will we find them? And what sorts of pedigree will they have? So it'll be interesting to see if your prediction bears out.
We'll see. I hope it does. For all the people out there who, like me, never thought they would be law professors, I really hope that it does, because this is the best job in the world.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing more about what makes you passionate. And I'm glad you're literally out of the closet.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you. I hope it was a big closet. I meant to say that earlier.
It was a decent sized closet. I'm not going to lie about the size. It was a decent sized closet. So I cannot complain about that.
Well, I'm looking at a very good sized office that you're sitting in right now, bigger than any closet, I'm sure. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of EdUp Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. EdUp Legal is part of the EdUp Experience podcast network, bringing you the brightest and most influential minds across higher education and beyond. Here at EdUp, we make education your business.